My castaway this week is a journalist and author. Since the age of 29, muscular dystrophy has kept him in a wheelchair. Nevertheless, at the age of nearly 70, he can look back on a life more vivid and exciting than most able-bodied men. He was sacked from Eton and sent down from Cambridge. He's crossed deserts and driven 24,000 miles across South America. In between, he's worked as a gossip columnist, film critic, and perhaps most famously, as a writer on restaurants. A friend of the rich, famous, and influential, he's also been married three times. Nothing, he says, debars a disabled person from the really important things in life: love, happiness, and achievement. He is Quentin Crewe. In fact, you wrote that, Quentin, in a letter to Christopher Reeve, who's paralysed, of course, after a riding accident. On the whole, it has to be said, your attitude to disabled people seems to be fairly merciless. It's kind of put up and shut up, isn't it?
Well, slightly that. It's more that I feel that one can do everything. I mean, the thing I'd like to give to everybody was confidence, which, of course, is a hard thing to give. I mean, I think the people who complain about rights and all that stuff, you've just got to accept you can't do some things. I'm not going to walk along Hadrian's Wall, nor do I want it to be despoiled for the disabled by putting a nasty tarmac road beside it.
But you've got to be blessed with a certain very positive frame of mind, a strength of character, haven't you, in order to do it?
I suppose so, yes.
You can't just affect it, can you?
No, but I think my parents were very austere with me about that, and that helped me in a way, because they weren't going to have any nonsense from me, and told me to get on with it.
But at what age were you diagnosed as having muscular dystrophy?
Oh, about 6 or 7.
And what were you told then?
Well, my mother was told I'd be dead by the time I was 16, and I was told I'd be all right by the time I was 16. Perhaps he had a thought of I'd be in heaven, I don't know. But anyhow, so I rather fatuously, although it was perfectly plain, went on hoping that somehow around about 16 that everything would come right, but it didn't. So.
Could you feel yourself getting steadily worse between the ages of 6 and 16?
Yes.
But presumably your family then cosseted you rather, because they believed you were going to die.
No, they didn't cosset me at all. I mean, that wasn't their nature. I mean, certainly not my mother's nature. If you were going to die, you were going to die. And you had to get on with it, too.
So are you saying that that's why you feel you have this kind of positive attitude, that the family...
I think, yes, to a large extent.
Of course, that perhaps makes it different for you from, say, Christopher Reeve, who suddenly, overnight, is rendered paralysed.
Oh, yes, it's absolutely terrible for somebody who one day is a young, athletic man, and the next day can't do anything. But I feel he's got a spirit and that he will overcome a lot.
Tell me about your first record.
My first record really is because I've had many associations with France. My father was British consul in the Riviera. We lived in Nice. I've always been going back to France a lot. And then I lived in France for 10 years. So Charles Trenet singing Douce France is, to me, very evocative.
Douce France, cher pays de mon enfance, bercé de tendre insouciance, je t'ai gardé dans mon cœur. Mon village, au clocher, aux maisons sages, où les enfants de mon âge.
Charles Trenet singing La Douce France. I suppose one would expect, really, as a result of not being able to play sport, that you would have been quite a studious chap, but nothing of the kind, apparently. You were a slacker.
Yes. I mean, I couldn't play football or anything, that was that. But when I got to Cambridge, I did become very interested in rowing. I was a cox steering the boat, and that I found great fun.
But tell me about Eton, because you've written that it was absurd and unnatural. In what ways was it absurd and unnatural?
Well, in the way that, I mean, the rules were so preposterous that you couldn't walk about. You had to carry your umbrella not rolled up, but flapping like a rook at your side. And you had to wear your collar turned up. You weren't allowed to turn your overcoat collar down. You had to walk on one side of the street, not the other. Even if you were going to go from one shop to another that were 30 yards apart, you had to cross the road and then cross back again. So many idiotic rules. And then on top of that, you had the boys disciplining one another, beating one another, and that seemed to me unreasonable.
But what you describe, obviously, is that you were a natural rebel, a non-conformist. You've also written some very nasty adjectives about yourself, actually. You said you were tiresome and unlikable, but perhaps the most frequent adjective you use about yourself is sly. You were sly.
Yes, I think I was quite crafty. I mean, my housemaster at Eton wrote a letter to the other masters who were teaching me to beware of my charm because I would get round them. And I thought, well, yes, who wouldn't? And so, yes, there was a bit of that.
But how much do you think the coldness in your family, which you mentioned just now, had to do with that, that you just felt rather on your own and you had to get out there and manipulate the world, rather?
Oh, no, I had a brother, you see. I had a full brother. I had many half-brothers and sisters. And my full brother was the most amazing friend I've ever had. Really.
But your father wasn't always very kind to you, was he?
Well, he was. I mean, remember, they were so much older than them. I mean, my father was 46 when I was born and my mother 45. So, I mean, the gulf was huge. And he had ideas that you should be afraid of your parents. So he used to set out to make us afraid of him. I mean, he had very eccentric ways about teaching one things. I mean, he thought fencing would be a good thing for me to do when I was at school. And so he was a champion fencer originally. And so we used to fence on the terrace at home. Every time we came for a joust or whatever you call it, he would, by some trick, flick my sword out of my hand and halfway down the garden. I had to run down and fetch it. But he'd do this again and again. Yeah, he was odd in that way.
You've written that when your mother died, eventually you were remarkably unmoved by her death.
Yeah, I was, really, because I wasn't close to her. I mean, there were moments of being close to her in the sense she was always good company and she laughed a lot. But there was no warmth there. And she didn't particularly like her children, I don't think. Two of her sons by her first husband were killed in the war and she was not really that distressed.
So are you saying that the only genuine affection you knew in your childhood was really from your brother?
Yes, largely. Oh, no, my eldest half-sister was very affectionate.
Mm. But not, you didn't know parental love?
No.
Tell me about record number two.
Record number two comes from the opera Forzetta del Destino, in which Don Alvaro and Don Carlos are swearing eternal friendship. And it doesn't actually, the end, work out like that. But that's what to my mind, friends have been the most important thing in my life. And music, largely, reminds me of particular friends.
Placido Domingo and Giorgio Zancanoro singing the duet Amici in Vita e in Morte from Verdi's La Forza del Destino. There seems to have been, Quentin Crewe, the odd Canaletto knocking round the family home and a copy of Kubla Khan in Coleridge's own hand. How much impression did those kinds of things make on you as a boy?
Oh, I think a lot. That sort of thing my father was good at. He set me to go through all the books in the library, which was vast, and to find myself sitting with Philip Sidney's copy of something or King Charles II's copy of something was fantastic. And there was a book, unbelievably odd book, called Glauber's Furnaces. And this had belonged to Oliver Cromwell. And he'd sketched a battle on the front or some page at the beginning. And he'd got me and Fairfax all noted down, and then enemy at the other side. And he got the plan of the battle. I don't know which battle. And why he had a copy of Glauber's Furnaces, which were literally boilers or whatever, heaven knows. But that sort of thing was so vivid to hold in one's hand.
You had in your mid-20s, I think, what some might think of as an idyllic job, reading out loud to a blind man in a beautiful villa that tumbled down to the sea, or his gardens tumbled down to the sea anyway, in Italy. What did you read to him? Who was he and what did you read to him?
He was called Percy Lubbock, and he was a person who had been a great friend of Henry James and of Edith Wharton, so he was full of anecdote from that period and those people. And we spent, I don't know how many hours a day reading. In the morning, I'd read the newspapers in Italian. In the afternoon, evening, I'd read things like The New Statesman. Then a serious book, perhaps, about science. I don't know, he was interested in science and astronomy. And then later, after dinner, we'd read Anna Karenina or something of that sort. And it was a wonderful education, absolutely lovely.
Is that where you develop the desire to write? Or
yes, yes, certainly.
You must have learned so much as well.
I learned a lot. Certainly I would have been much too lazy to have sat down and read all that stuff for myself, I think.
But you were perhaps in the mood to be there and to take such a job because, of course, you'd escaped from a love affair. Well, you'd run away from a lost love, from Sarah Macmillan, daughter of Harold, hadn't you?
Yes, I had, really.
You were 22, I think, when you'd first fallen in love with her, and it's gone on for some years. Was she the first woman to break your heart?
Yeah, absolutely. She was wonderful, and I was immensely fond of her and of her whole family. It was a curious relationship, really, because her mother became extremely close to me.
I want to ask you some more about that, but let's pause there for your third record. Tell me about that.
Well, the third record really does remind me of Sarah. I had, anyhow, at that time, a great enthusiasm for swing and jazz and sort of Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw and all that. But Sarah was very fond of her Fats Waller, my very good friend, the milkman.
My very good friend, the milkman, says that I've been losing too much sleep. He doesn't like the hours I keep. He suggests that you should marry me. Ah, turn it loose. My very good friend, the mailman, says that it would make his burden less.
Fats Waller and my very good friend, the milkman. You were Quentin Crewe virtually adopted by the Macmillan family. They became your surrogate family. You moved in to Birch Grove, the family
absolutely.
Home.
Yeah, absolutely. I used to spend every weekend there.
But as you say, you were really almost closer to Lady Dorothy than to Sarah.
Well, in some ways. I mean, particularly after Sarah had decided she wasn't going to marry me, but wanted to marry somebody else.
Lady Dorothy apparently used to sit on the end of your bath and talk to you, is that right?
Yes, yes.
But what did she talk? Were you her confidant?
Yes. She would tell me anything, really. And did. And
about her attitude to her husband and her lover?
Well,
Bob
particularly
Boothby.
About her relationship with Boothby. I think it was tormenting for Harold because he was fond of her, no doubt. One of the things that I'm absolutely convinced about is that I think John Juno or somebody suggested that he was homosexual. I don't know who did put that suggestion, but anyhow, there it was. And one day Dorothy said to me, look, go through all those letters in that cabinet over there. And I went through them and they were all intensely intimate. I mean, very intimate indeed. And even letters from Harold apologising for bothering her. And so, I mean, he certainly was keen on her, but she wasn't on him. I mean, it was a very sad affair. But I think she was a passionate woman.
The Macmillans, in a sense, weren't your only surrogate family, were they? You'd also lived at one point with the Bonham Carters and got on very well with Lady Violet.
Well, that was much earlier. That was when I first came to work in London. And she used to have PGs, really. She was a funny lady, really. So powerful, so determined and so upright, you know. I mean, there's this searing honesty which was quite frightening. I mean, she'd... I remember going to a party once and there was Tom Dreiberg there, and she said, "Oh, there's Tom Dreiberg. I must go and tell him what a bad thing he wrote the other day." So I said, "Well, why do you have to tell him that? Why can't you just ignore it? He might think I approved of it," she said. I mean, she was formidable.
But she used to wait up for you at the end of an evening,
she just never went to bed, really. So I used to tiptoe in and try to creep up to my bedroom, but she'd call out for if she'd like to chat.
But what was in all of this for you? Did you just enjoy sort of middle-aged women in the sense of mother figures, do you think? Or was this your...
No, she was not that at all. There's certainly no surrogate mother.
Or with Lady Dorothy?
Well, more with Lady Dorothy, yes. I think I thought of her as a surrogate mother, really.
You did, did you?
I did, yes. I think so.
And you went on corresponding for a long time after you left Birchgrove,
didn't
you?
Oh, yes. I mean, from Italy, I wrote a lot of letters, and she wrote a lot of letters to me. And then when I came back to England, I then used to continue to go down there to Birchgrove every weekend.
Tell me about record number four.
Record number four is Wynton Marsalis playing Hummel's Concerto for the Trumpet. I think I'm very keen on wind instruments, really, and this is a supreme example.
Part of Johann Hummel's Concerto for Trumpet and Orchestra in E major, played by Wynton Marsalis with the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Raymond Leppard. How did you get your first full-time job in journalism, Quentin?
Well, I'd come back ready for the coronation in 1953, and I was asked to lunch by Boothby, and there happened to be at lunch John Juno, who later became the famous editor of the Sunday Express. But he was then deputy editor, newly appointed, of the Evening Standard. And he asked me what I was doing, and I told him. And then he said, "Well, would you like to come and work for us on the Evening Standard?" So I joined the Evening Standard and worked.
You'd have been, what, about 27 by that? And you became a kind of roving reporter, didn't you? How did you manage? Were you still... Because you were still on your feet, as it were, at that stage.
Yes, I got a wheelchair about then, but I used to get around. I had a car, I drove. And
but you were being asked to, at 10 minutes' notice, to go to Edinburgh or go to somewhere in Europe.
Yeah, I loved that. It was just exactly what I liked. I think the first job I was sent off to Monte Carlo because they'd got an idea that Aristotle Onassis was going to turn it into a port, I mean, a serious port with the stevedores and all the rest of it. And so I was then sent down to discover whether this was true or not. And came back saying, no, I didn't really think it was. And anyhow, I wrote quite a funny piece. And so that, I think, was my first feature article. And then I was taken on to the Londoner's Diary. And it went on from there.
But you said since that journalism, or you've written since, journalism asks for many compromises with principles. Did you find yourself writing things that you'd really prefer not to have done?
Working for a gossip column, well, like the Londoner's Diary, yes. And I very often used to lie. They'd say, "Ring up so-and-so." If it was somebody I didn't want to write about, I'd say, "They weren't in." I mean, it was quite simple.
So you protected your friends, did you?
Yes.
So then by the 1960s, decade on, you were very much a man about town, weren't you, with such figures as Ken Tynan and Jocelyn Stevens and Mark Boxer, Anthony Armstrong Jones and so on. By then you were an assistant editor of Queen magazine. What was your role there?
Really, just a feature writer and commissioning articles and that kind of thing.
But great fun.
Yes.
Best time of your life?
No, I don't think so. And I wouldn't ever know which was the best time of my life. Yeah, the best time of my life is when I'm travelling, really.
Which I want to talk about, but let's have another record there. Number five.
Number five is the original Girl from Ipanema, Astrid Gilberto. But the reason I pick this is partly because of later travels in South America, but also it's somehow nearer what I used to enjoy in those days, which was Caribbean music and calypso. But as we can't have too many records, I thought that this would have to do for both the Caribbean and South America.
Tall and tan and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes, ah. When she walks, she's like a samba that swings so cool and sways so gently, that when she passes, each one she passes goes, ah.
Astrid Gilberto and the original Girl from Ipanema. Then, Quentin Crewe, you became later on a restaurant correspondent, Meals on Wheels, as you were known by the stage. Some credit you with inventing the restaurant column as we know it today. Is there some truth in that?
Well, I think there is, really, because there was an emergency on Queen Magazine, because the girl who did the little short things about restaurants was ill, and we had a blank half page. And I said, well, I'm going out to lunch, so I'll write about it. I went to Wilton's, very posh restaurant, and again, I made it funny, but the difference was that I always thought it was rather disgusting writing about food, and people were going to read this paper at breakfast, and they didn't want to hear about a greasy veal chop. And so I wrote less about the food itself, except to say whether it was good or bad, and more about the kind of restaurant, the kind of people who were there, the decor of the restaurant, and reviewing it more sort of all over. And I remember actually I was lucky there, but Wilton's, because it was full of a lot of toffs, and the bills were enormously high, and I remember writing that the bills, as befitted the clientele, were aimed more like death duties at capital rather than income. And so I took that sort of lie.
But as a result of that reputation that you then won, writing about restaurants, and you ended up writing a restaurant column for Vogue and so on, you got much later on what your friend Bernard Levin has described as the fantasy commission from a publisher to write a book about all the Michelin three-star restaurants in France outside Paris, a job which would require extensive and painstaking research. Was it the joy that it would seem to be that?
Absolutely,
commission?
Yes. Except that I used to get so full, because I used to stay about 3 days in each restaurant and try and eat a sort of full gastronomic three-star meal
every night,
twice a day for 3 days is impossible. It used to take a young man to help me and drive and that kind of thing. And I hit on one, luckily, who could eat twice as much as anybody else. And so if I couldn't finish it, he ate it all up.
So you could sample everything?
Yes.
But what is your favourite kind of restaurant, Quentin? I mean, where would you go out of choice? What kind of restaurant would you go to?
Well, I do, in the end, always prefer French food to any other. But, I mean, that's, of course, except if one's in Italy. I love that, too. And I love good Chinese food. But when people ask, well, which is your favourite restaurant, that is always a question. It depends. I mean, what for? To take your granny, to take your mistress, to take your boss, or where, you know?
Mm. Next record number six.
One of the four last songs of Jesse Norman by Richard Strauss. While I was living in France, somehow music came into my life much more, and in particular because the hamlet where I was living, very often there came the opera producer Richard Carson, and one day he brought me a tape of Jesse Norman and the four last songs. And by a curious chance, one day I was flying out from Marseille Airport, and there I suddenly saw Jessie Norman getting out of a car laden with flowers, this majestic figure, and I sort of fell for her, because not only because I liked her singing, but because she was so nice to everybody who was helping her. She was modest and unassuming at the check-in counter, and really such a delightful person, plainly.
Jessie Norman singing Beim Schlafengehen, one of Richard Strauss's four last songs, with the Gewandhaus Orchestra of Leipzig, conducted by Kurt Masur. You've had, Quentin, what you've described as a third life, apart from your professional and personal life, into which you disappeared from time to time, and that's travel. You've crossed the empty quarter of Saudi Arabia, you've explored South America and the Caribbean, and you've lived in India and Japan. Why have you done it? Have you been searching for something, and if so, have you found it?
I think I'm a nomad by nature, really. All travel excites me. I like meeting the people. I like everything to do with it. And I like seeing new things. I mean, in South America, the landscape is just something you can't ever forget. I mean, it just impresses itself on you. But then, of course, there are also the Caribbean islands and the people, mostly. The architecture in some places.
Have you brushed with death on these travels?
Oh, in the desert, yes. Both in Saudi Arabia, where it was dangerous for all sorts of different reasons, and in the Sahara, where I drove into a minefield and got blown up, and in the Saudi Arabian desert, the interpreter I had went mad. He attacked me and my friend who I was travelling with, a photographer, and all that was very alarming.
So, as you say, it's another whole life you've led somewhere else, another kind of freedom you've found.
That's right.
Really. How much is that connected, though, with your disability, with the need to prove that you can do it, as you were saying at the beginning, that you can do anything if you really want to?
I often wonder. I never know. I mean, I really don't know whether I do it to prove something. I mean, the Sahara trip, which did take nearly a year and a half, I did during the International Year of the Disabled. And I thought, well, this is quite a good way of showing what the disabled can do. And
but you have a lot of help. You take fit young men to carry
I had, on that occasion, a photographer and a mechanic to look after the cars and a young man to push, really.
Oh. You've also, of course, had three beautiful wives, Martha, Angie, and Sue. All of them with each other and with you and with the five children, all of you remain friends, don't
Yes,
you?
Absolutely.
All of you speak to each other, which is an achievement in itself. But let me ask you this. How much did your disability have to do with the fact that those three marriages ended?
I think a lot, actually. It's very demanding living with somebody who's disabled. I think it's a burden for them that some people manage it better than others. So again, it's a bit like one's favourite restaurant. One can't pick one's favourite wife. What for, so to speak, again? Each of them had different qualities. All of them were admirable, and they taught me many things. But it is a burden. I mean, I always feel sorry for the wives of people who are disabled.
Next record, number 7.
The next record is really to do with the desert. Those desert trips, the reason I loved them was you are reduced to really three things: water, food to some extent, and the way. Finding the way. And it's that austerity which I like, the fact that you are reduced to that. And no other considerations really that matter. So this song by Nelly Lutcher, a blues singer, which is about the desert and cool water, it's called. And it's about mirages and what you see and how you must not be deflected by a mirage.
Oh, keep a moving, Dan. Don't you listen to him, Dan. He's a devil, not a man. He sprays the burning sand with water. Dan, can't you see that big green tree where the water's running free? It's waiting there for you and me.
Nelly Lutcher singing Cool Water. You didn't, as the doctor had predicted, die at 16, Quentin Crewe. You're, in fact, 70 later this year. What is the state of your muscular dystrophy today?
Well, gradually I can do less. Various bits of it get to be less useful. But I seem to manage a lot of things. Again, I'm helped by the boys who help me around, and so I get to where I want to get to.
So it's just not something that occupies your thoughts?
No,
really.
I think if you start... I think that's another problem of today, actually, is people so self-absorbed fussing about themselves. I don't fuss about myself. I don't want to fuss about myself. And so I just like to get on with things.
Because, again, you've written happiness versus unhappiness, hope versus fear. For me, those are questions of choice. Is it really possible to exert such control over your emotions?
Yes, one sees people surrendering to unhappiness. And I just hope. I mean, well, it may not work, but let's try, I think.
So that rather sly, fickle young boy that you described has become, some would say, stoical. Perhaps you're just capable of supreme intellectual self-control. Is that what it is?
Well, I don't think I'd put it as grandly as that myself. I think it's an insouciance, if you like. I mean, I feel happy most of the time. All right, of course one has days when one feels gloomy, but I really feel very happy.
Last record.
And the last record is really a tribute to one of the young men who has looked after me, who came some years ago, and he introduced me to a lot more music. He introduced me to Schubert's string quintet, but much, much more. He himself is a musician, mad cricketer, and he's just got married, and it's lovely. So it is the adagio from Schubert's string quintet.
Part of the second movement of Schubert's string quintet in C major, played by the Melos Quartet with Mstislav Rostropovich. If you could only take one of those eight records, Quentin.
I think probably that one. Any mood it suits, in a way. So it would be that.
What about your book? Bible and Shakespeare are there.
I'll take Montaigne's essays, because they shed light on such an extraordinary light on things we all think about.
And what about your luxury?
Well, my luxury, I think I want to have the whole of the cellar from Trinity College, Cambridge.
The complete works of Trinity College, Cambridge cellar.
That'll keep me going.
I'm certain it will. Quentin Crewe, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much. Thank you.